they better gather up our warriors, cause tonight is the big fight. Hey, 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 hey. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, 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 hey.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, we have Press Watch at 9 with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire. Pair talks to journalist Daniel Lazaro about his latest article that asks, is Saudi Arabia the Middle East's next failed state? At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with author Dubravka Ugrechlik about her new novel, Fox, and a revised and updated essay collection, American Fictionary.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Friends of Noise October Youth Showcase on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Rockwood Center in Portland. Local bands The Day, White Lotus, and Seven will be playing the Friends of Noise Youth Showcase this month. Friends of Noise is a nonprofit that works to create more space for all ages music and arts, and aims to open a music and arts venue. Again, that's the Friends of Noise October Youth Showcase featuring The Day, White Lotus, and Seven on Saturday, October 20th from 6 to 11 p.m. at the Rockwood Center, 17805 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Come up in the party, get drinking in the lobby.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Saturday Market. 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland. Featuring live music and Kids Corner events, Portland Saturday Market, every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more is available online at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
Good morning. This is Press Watch, left agitation in the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Breaking news, the U.S. president, spewing more racist demagoguery and hatred on Twitter, is threatening to close the U.S.-Mexico border and send in troops to prevent another desperate pilgrimage of refugees from attempting to flee to the United States. The president seems very frustrated about this. The refugees are fleeing U.S.-supported state terror and economic devastation in Honduras and are currently passing through Mexico, though the Mexican authorities are trying to stop them. And when I say it's U.S.-supported state terror and economic devastation in Honduras, I would encourage you to look at news articles on Honduras and see the tone, but you need to know some history. And maybe there's another thing that would be helpful to get the point across, and that is to pull up a map, and preferably a satellite map that you can get these days, of Tegucigalpa, capital of Honduras, and have a look at just how much space the U.S. base takes up there. That country is actually a colony. In effect, it's not legally a colony. Asked to comment on a new possible family separations policy, Donald Trump said on Saturday, "We're looking at everything that you could look at when it comes to illegal immigration," end quote. He confirmed that his administration is considering plans that would resume family separations at the southern border. So it would appear that this fight is not over. The refugees, meanwhile, are trying to get here, though the Mexican authorities are trying to stop them, and though the U.S. border has been locked fairly tightly. And as a matter of fact, that's why so many people are coming illegally, though they can claim refugee status. They're being effectively prevented by crossing the border, prevented from crossing the border. Quoting an article from The Hill, the Washington Post reported on Friday that in an effort to reduce illegal crossings, the government is weighing offering asylum-seeking migrants what it calls the binary choice option. After about 3 weeks in immigration detention together, parents could choose to keep their children with them as their case proceeds in jail, which could take months or years, or opt to give up their kids to a relative or a guardian. Under the terms of the Flores settlement, a court agreement that limits the amount of time the kids can stay in detention for 20 days, this proposal would be legal. That doesn't mean it's a good idea, they write. Actually, either of these options would be cruel for the families involved. It would be forcing a potentially life-altering decision on Central American parents who have already been traumatized by gangs, violence, and persecution in their home countries. It is likely that some parents would agree to give up their children out of desperation without fully understanding the consequences of their actions, or that they would be coerced into doing so. And speaking for myself, few things more coercive than being locked up by people who have guns. They write, the Trump administration already has a terrible record of caring for immigrant children in their custody, with credible abuse, with credible reports of abuse and inhumane conditions at migrant shelters. The administration's original policy of family separations, which took at least 2,500 children from their parents, was a logistical, political, and humanitarian disaster. It drew bipartisan and worldwide condemnation until Trump signed an executive order halting the practice in June. Then a federal judge ordered the reunification of all separated parents and children, a process which is still not complete. And speaking for myself, intentionally not so. That's called foot dragging. It's called slow walking. Returning to the text, some migrant parents may never see their children again because they were deported without their kids. Although that mess hasn't even been cleaned up yet, with at least 136 kids not reunited with their parents, it appears that the administration is ready to make a new one. The administration is weighing the so-called binary choice option because illegal border crossings are up, according to Department of Homeland Security data. August saw a 38% increase in migrant family members arrested and charged with illegal entries. And speaking for myself again, these are people who have been forced to find another way in because they've been forced to wait for days and not allowed to pass through the border legally with their asylum claim. Asylum claims that countries all over the world do. It's a part of being a civilized country, but this isn't. Returning to the article, Trump feels that the way to deal with this crisis is with a new family separation policy. Quote, if they feel there will be more separation, they won't come, quote. And that's what he told reporters Saturday. The fact that families are still arriving at the border, they write from Central America, belies this assertion. If the threat of family separation were an effective deterrent to illegal entries, we wouldn't be in this situation again. And again, speaking for myself, it's also an admission that family separation is state terror. He said, if they feel there will be more separation, they won't come. In other words, the terror is here, so don't come. Previously, Trump wouldn't admit that, but he has said that, and he has also repeated it essentially to Leslie Stahl, which makes me want to turn to Washington Post article titled The Fix Analysis. An internal report lays bare the Trump administration's dishonesty about family separations. It's by Aaron Blake. And he writes, a new Inspector General's report about the Trump administration's separation of families at the U.S.-Mexico border begins with a damning assessment, and it only gets worse from there. Here's a summary. DHS was not fully prepared to implement the administration's zero-tolerance policy or to deal with some of its aftereffects. Faced with resource limitations and other challenges, the Department of Homeland Security regulated the number of asylum seekers entering the country through ports of entry at the same time that it encouraged asylum seekers to come to the ports. During zero-tolerance, CBP also held alien children separated from their parents for extended periods in facilities intended solely for short-term detention, end quote. And since I want to emphasize I was quoting, I don't like to use the word alien, and alien children, it seems especially offensive, especially in the the context that we find ourselves. He writes, DHS also struggled to identify, track, and reunify families separated under zero tolerance due to limitations with its information technology systems, including a lack of integration between systems. And here again, I would like to say they're really, really giving them a break, because it's obvious that they were slow walking, that they were dragging their feet, that they didn't enter information in order to create disappeared persons, and they were effective in that. If you doubt that at all, please look at the way everyone else is so carefully tracked. Numbered, identified, facial recognition. You don't lose people by accident. Big governmental, well-funded governmental organizations don't lose people by accident. Not when they've had them in custody and chance to photograph and fingerprint and detect, inspect, and infect, as Arlo would say. So the Trump administration is planning to make things worse. They've been caught out now. Although they, you know, the press, like the Washington Post, so much of the press won't call out an obvious contradiction. Often is not. It's just a habit, I think, from decades of conformity with the imperialist government. But the fact is, Trump has been caught out again lying. So, returning to the first article, instead, the U.S. is in the midst of another spike in illegal crossings by families at the southern border, yet there isn't sound evidence that deterrence strategies work. And going to skip ahead on that article. Well, actually, that's about all that I want to read from that article, but I want to comment that Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler was confronted by a silent protest yesterday as he left City Hall. It was over his failure to attempt to remove the Portland ICE detention facility on breach of contract grounds. The contract doesn't allow torture, doesn't allow cruelty, humanitarian failures. So it's quite possible to take them to court and get them out of Portland. And I don't think Wheeler's willing to go that far. And so there was a protest. They stood and held signs as he left City Hall at the end of his day. Time is 9:12. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And now it's time for This Week in Whiteness. This week comes the almost incredible news of a group of 40 senior citizens who in this year, 2018, and just this week had boarded a bus in Georgia to take them to vote. Voting isn't easy in Georgia because even if you live in crushing economic conditions, or if you're octogenarian or better and have lived in one place all your life, you're expected to produce a photo, driver's license, or ID well in advance of election day to be able to vote. Well, these voters had done all that, and all 40 of them had boarded the bus, taking their time because they're senior citizens, and I would know, when they were removed by white officials on the pretext of, never mind the ridiculous pretext, they pressured the person organizing the ride to force them off. They were removed from the bus on the basis of being black and wanting to vote. This putrescent exhibition of 21st century Jim Crow was successful as the bus was halted and the voters were unable to get to the polls that way. But you can bet that they will try again, because that was the early voting bus, and I suspect that the bus was set up to go on that first day of early voting because they know the society that they live in. I was watching television coverage of the latest major hurricane disaster and heard a woman say to the camera with evident fear that she only had 4 days worth of cash remaining, and I felt for her in that moment, because though she was in a disaster zone, possibly unable to get out and receiving food aid, though her shelter was probably damaged, inadequate, or missing, she knew that she was also in 2018 America and needed cash to survive. In a sane society, cash would have nothing to do with her condition in a disaster zone, and rescue efforts would cover human needs and human rights, and certainly that includes shelter. But in this benighted society, if it is a society, even the shattered survivors of a 150-mile-per-hour hurricane and a storm surge that obviously washed many people out to sea must provide a constant flow of cash for rents, mortgages, utilities, etc., or face the crushing weight of a collapse of their credit. And they don't have cash, they aren't getting any food or shelter. This is something that we take for granted. It's unnatural. It's wrong. It's a recent perversion. I have an article by Robert Reich on that topic. He writes, "I keep hearing that although Donald Trump is a scoundrel or worse, at least he's presiding over a great economy. As White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow recently put it, the single biggest story this year is an economic boom that is durable and lasting." And he writes, "Really? Look closely at the living standards of most Americans, and you get a very different picture." And I have to agree with Robert Reich. Look around. Are people still living on sidewalks? Is that grandma? Yep. So all this talk of an economic boom is obviously a lie for 90% of us. 10-11%, something like that, are doing really well. Fraction of 1% are doing super well with that $1.5 trillion tax giveaway. Whenever you hear there's not enough money to go around, remember $1.5 trillion, that's 1.5 thousand billion. And a billion is 1,000 million, remember that. An unbelievable amount of money given away to the ruling class, to the inheritance class. Well, he writes, "Yes, the stock market has boomed since Trump became president, but it's looking increasingly wobbly as Trump's trade wars take a toll. Over 80% of the stock market is owned by the richest 10% of Americans anyway, so most Americans never got much out of Trump's market boom to begin with. And speaking for myself, before you argue that there's more investment and that your pension is involved in the stock market and blah, blah, well, your pension may be in the stock market, but you're not going to receive the gains. That's going to go to the stockbrokers. Now, if it takes a fall, that'll be the end of your pension. That's different. You can take a loss from this system that props up the rich, but you aren't going to get rich." Returning to Reich's article, "The trade wars are about to take a toll on ordinary workers. Trump's steel tariffs have cost Ford $1 billion so far, by example, forcing the automaker to plan mass layoffs." He writes, "What about economic growth? Data from the Commerce Department shows the economy at full speed, 4.2% growth for the second quarter, but very little of that growth is trickling down to average Americans. Adjusted for inflation, hourly wages aren't much higher now than they were 40 years ago." Trump, if you can get a job, speaking for myself. Returning to his text, Trump slashed taxes on the wealthy and promised everyone a $4,000 wage boost. But the boost never happened. That's a big reason why Republicans aren't campaigning on their tax cut, which is about their only legislative accomplishment. Trump and congressional Republicans refused to raise the minimum wage, stuck at $7.25 an hour. Trump's Labor Department is also repealing a rule that increased the number of workers entitled to time and a half for overtime. Yes, employment is down. Unemployment is down to 3.7%, but jobs are less secure than ever. Contract workers who aren't eligible for family or medical leave, unemployment insurance, the minimum wage, or workers' compensation are now doing one out of every five jobs in America. Again, speaking for myself, as this is going on right now, the House of Representatives is cobbling up and working on a bill that would reduce Social Security payouts. And the details are complicated, and you'd have to know the Social Security system better than I do to understand them. But the bottom line is they'll be taking money away from Social Security recipients. And that's a constant thing for Republican Congress. 918, you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Trump's Labor Department, he writes, has invited more companies to reclassify employees as contract workers. Its new rule undoes the California Supreme Court's recent decision requiring that most workers be presumed employees unless proven otherwise. Given California's size, that decision had a nationwide effect. Meanwhile, housing costs are skyrocketing, with Americans now paying a third or more of their paychecks in rent or mortgages. Trump's response? Drastic cuts in low-income housing. His Secretary of Housing and Urban Development also wants to triple the rent paid by poor households and subsidize housing. Let me say that again. Wants to triple the rent. Healthcare costs continue to rise faster than inflation. Trump's response? Undermine the Affordable Care Act. Over the past 2 years, some 4 million people have lost healthcare coverage, according to a survey by the Commonwealth Fund. Pharmaceutical costs are also out of control. Trump's response allowed the biggest pharmacist, CVS, to merge with one of the biggest health insurance, biggest health insurers, Aetna, creating a behemoth with the power to raise prices even further. The cost of college continues to soar. Trump's response make it easier for for-profit colleges to defraud students, Reich writes. His Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is eliminating regulations that had required for-profit colleges to prove they provide gainful employment to the students they enroll. Commuting to and from work is becoming harder as roads and bridges become more congested and subways and trains older and less reliable. And Trump's response, nothing, although he promised to spend $1.5 trillion to repair America's crumbling infrastructure. Remember that? His $1.5 trillion tax cut for big corporations and the wealthy used up the money. Surprise! Climate change, he writes, is undermining the standard of living of ordinary Americans as more are hit with floods, mudslides, tornadoes, droughts, and wildfire. Even those who have so far avoided direct hits will be paying more for insurance or having a harder time getting it. People living on floodplains or in trailers or without home insurance are paying the highest price. Trump's response, allow more carbon into the atmosphere and make climate change even worse. Reich writes, too often discussions about the economy focus on overall statistics about growth, the stock market, and unemployment. But most Americans don't live in that economy. They live in a personal economy that has more to do with wages, job security, commutes to and from work, the cost of housing, healthcare, drugs, education, and home insurance. These are the things that hit closest to home. They comprise the typical American standard of living. Instead of an economic boom, most Americans are experiencing declines in all these dimensions of their lives. Trump isn't solely responsible. Some of these trends predated his presidency, but he hasn't done anything to reverse them. If anything, he's made them far worse. And I want to talk about the structure now of the United States and how it is made to be very difficult, if not impossible, to actually change things. And it's a very contradictory thing. It's a complex thing because I'm excited about the fact that I can vote. I've filled out my ballot. And I'm going to bring it in today, I believe, and I urge you to do the same. It's very important. On the other hand, it's also very restricted. But this is your chance to have some effect on what is actually going on. And it is very concerning to the powers that be, and that's why the Republicans are going around vote caging, making sure that people can't vote, making sure that black citizens can't get on buses to vote, doing anything, no matter how outrageous, to steal the vote away, because it does have some power. And my advice to you is, you get some power, grab it. Even if it's not enough, we'll just have to take care of that as we go along, won't we? Well, there was another article in Truth Dig, which I found to be very interesting and relevant to what I was just talking about. It's by Paul Street, and the discussion begins with comments about whiteness reflected in police shootings. And it's about the fact that we live in an authoritarian society, and it infects our thinking. He writes, well down into the article, how does a right-wing Republican majority in the U.S. Senate get to confirm a militantly anti-democratic sexist and partisan hack to the highest court in the land when U.S. public opinion stands well to the left of both Kavanaugh and the GOP on countless policy issues, including union rights, affirmative action, environmental regulation, campaign finance, abortion, the need for a viable third and fourth parties, gun control, same-sex marriage, taxation, and more. And speaking for myself, all of those articles, if you take the poll, you find that Americans are far to the left of the elected government. How'd this happen? Returning to the article, this can happen in no small part because the ludicrously venerated U.S. Constitution assigns 2 U.S. senators to each U.S. state, regardless of differences in population. Red Wyoming, home to more than 573,000 Americans, holds U.S. senatorial parity with Blue California, where 39.5 million Americans reside. That's 1 U.S. senator for every 19.5 Californians versus 1 U.S. senator for every 287 Wyoming residents. And if that just buzzed past you, let me try a different angle on that. It's approximately 50 or 60 times as many people for a senator. So if California, speaking for myself, were represented with the same power as Wyoming is, and remember that's a mostly white state and a very right-wing state. It would have 50 times as many senators, which is incredible. And there wouldn't be, it's incredible to think of, and it would be a very different outcome in the Senate. But the Senate is there to prevent democracy. It's to have little dukes from every state come out and to throw off proportional representation. But returning to the article, just one of New York City's five boroughs, Brooklyn, has 2.6 million people. If Brooklyn were a state and U.S. senators were apportioned there at the same populace-to-senator ratio as Wyoming, Brooklyn would have 9 U.S. senators. It's unlikely, he writes, that a single one of them would be a Republican. The following 13 states together have a combined population of roughly 34.4 million. That's Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. Together, these 13 red states send 26 Republicans to the U.S. Senate. California, with 5 million more people than these 13 states combined, sends 2 Democrats to the upper chamber of Congress. So again, speaking for myself, difference in representation, huge, and intentional, and structural. Returning to the article, the predominantly Democratic and half-black district of Columbia is home to 693,000 people, more than all of Wyoming, and just 46,000 fewer than that of Alaska. That it is denied a single U.S. senator in serious representation in the House of Representatives is preposterous. This profoundly undemocratic apportionment system means that Republican state majority answers to a disproportionately white, rural, and reactionary section of the electorate. Due to a growing population shift from the agricultural interior to crowded corridors along the coast, journalist Daniel Lazar noted last year, it is mathematically possible now to cobble together a Senate majority with states that account for just 17.6% of the popular vote. Other such anti-democratic traditions include, but are not limited to, an electoral college that triples the clout of the 8 smallest states and doubles that of the next 6. This is a ridiculous system that has ensured that 2 of the last 5 presidential elections have gone to the popular vote loser. That's 2000 and 2016. Rampant gerrymandering that tilts state legislatures and the House of Representatives far to the right of the populace exists. Strictly scheduled and time-staggered elections, combined with absurd propaganda telling Americans that they get real and significant policy input by selecting from a narrow spectrum of major party contenders once every 730 or 1,460 days, that's part of it. Also, a Supreme Court-mandated campaign system that, according to political scientists Martin Gilens and Benjamin Page, all but guarantees government policy reflects the wishes of those with money, not the wishes of the millions of ordinary citizens who turn out every 2 years to choose among the pre-approved, money-vetted candidates for federal office. And he writes, the openly plutocratic domination of U.S. politics, explicitly validated in the Supreme Court's 1976 Buckley v. Valeo and 2010 Citizens United decisions, is no small part of why the Democrats function as a dismal corporate centrism in the face of the Republicans' horrifying drift towards an Americaner fascism. So you can read more of that article at truthdig.com. I'm going to say another time because this is another site that is downvoted by the Google and Facebook algorithms in their effort to quash dissent. truthdig.com. I got challenged on my knowledge last week as a broadcast, and it was good for me. A right-winger said that my assertion that Dick Cheney had taken Dubai citizenship couldn't be true because they had looked it up on the web and said it wasn't there. So I tartly responded, I love being tart to righties, that just because he couldn't find something didn't mean it wasn't there, and that my mad skills in internet research would turn it up. So I did. Here's how you do it. You use Google Translate to convert search terms to Arabic, pull up websites using the Arabic, retranslate. Remember that Dubai is part of the United Arab Emirates. Search business details for UAE citizens. Here's what you get. Halliburton moved to Dubai in 2007. Cheney wasn't technically CEO then, but that's like saying Putin wasn't technically the leader of Russia when Medvedev was in office. Cheney was and is the major stockholder and their man in the White House. Businesses in the UAE must by law be owned by 51% by UAE citizens. This law was in effect in 2007, only changed in May of this year. Halliburton's records do not show such a transfer, nor did Cheney give up half his wealth. Only solution is for Cheney to become citizen pseudo-CEO, so like many super well-connected rich businessmen, he therefore had to undertake the prerequisite ceremony. But here's the thing, I can't prove that, but that's where it came from, and what I can prove is that you can find details like this if you know how to use web search engines. So you've been listening to Press Watch. Coming up, pair foggering with Daniel Lazaro about his latest article that asks, is Saudi Arabia the Middle East's next failed state at 10? Air Cascadia. So stay tuned to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And stay tuned to 90.7 FM in Cascadia and other frequencies and via KBOO.FM. My shout out to all the ships at sea.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st at 7:30 at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution gives one answer to the question, what happens when the community you need is not the community you have? Queer Core shows the development of the movement through the rise of artists who used radical queer identity to push back equally against gay assimilation and homophobic culture. The film features Bruce LaBruce, G.B. Jones, John Waters, Tom Jennings, Team Dresch, and many more. Again, that's the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st, 7:30, at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.